Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you would love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Newton D'Souza to talk about his book, The Multi-Skilled Designer, A Cognitive Foundation for Inclusive Architectural Thinking. Newton is an associate professor and the department chair at Florida International University in Miami. And thank you very much for being here and talking with me today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be here, and I appreciate this opportunity.
Not as much as me. So before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I was trained as an architect, and I, as you said, currently serve as an associate professor and chair of Interior Architecture Department at Florida International University, Miami. I also taught at the University of Missouri for about 10 years, where I was briefly a graduate program director. I completed my undergraduate architecture at Bangalore University in India, and went on to continue my master's at the National University of Singapore. And then I later on came to the United States to complete my doctorate at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
Great, very impressive. And so I'd like to just dive right into the book. It's very interesting. I do teach studio myself. And so no matter what year a student I'm dealing with, there is the question, what is design? And I believe that's actually how you open the book with that you're trying to explore the idea of ultimately what is design. Kind of a concept I think almost every person knows about, but if you were to ask them to define it or explain it, I think they might have more challenge than they realize.
Absolutely. And for me, I had the same question. So just kind of getting back to the journey of writing this book, what is design and what do designers really do? Was a question that was asked by one of my mentors. And that is after completing 5 years of my bachelor's of architecture and 5 years in the field, I went back to that question because there are so many complex processes that happen in design. And design is considered as a wicked problem. It's not well defined. And usually designers have to go through a whole process to define it. So my interest in conceptual design occurred when I was an undergraduate student, where I used to be very consumed with the conceptual process of design. And so much so that I used to change my designs even overnight just before the juries the next day. And often the juries would comment about my design as being too sketchy or underdeveloped. And so I was trying to figure out, is there a better way of me trying to design? Can I optimize my design thinking? What are the attributes of a good designer who can control their processes? And how do designers achieve their highest creative potential? So that led me to this whole area of design research called design cognition. And just to kind of talk a little bit about design cognition, in simple terms, it's about how designers think, create, and solve design problems. And design cognition comes from cognitive psychology, the mental processes that occur in our minds. And there's a whole group called Design Thinking Research Symposium who actually do a lot of work in this area. And they consist of people from architecture, from cognitive science, from computation, from other design disciplines. So it's an exciting area of research. And that's where I started my first initial steps into writing this book.
Very fascinating. And so we'll kind of go right into it. You outline this, that it's kind of based on, you know, initially Howard Gardner's 8 intelligences. And so I'll quickly break that down for us. The verbal, logical, mathematical, spatial, and I always mess this up, kinesthetic, musical, interpersonal, intrapersonal, and the naturalistic. And you kind of make the point that almost every profession has to use some combination of these, but architects are somewhat uniquely suited that they have to use almost all of them, and at the very least, much more than any other profession.
Yes, and that's a unique nature of our profession. We use a number of these different intelligences, although it's not explicitly taught in architecture school, or we don't name it as such. So in my research, I found that designers actually use many of these skills in different capacities. And that's where I felt the whole framework of Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences was suited to architecture. Howard Gardner comes from the view that measuring mental processes and representations shouldn't be just done by one form of intelligence, which is prevalently the intelligence quotient test we use. So his whole framework was to kind of diversify the thinking about intelligence. And that is something I felt was very useful to architecture, because we do conceptualize very differently, from spatial to logical. Sometimes we enter design just by storytelling. I have wonderful students who can write an essay before going to design. And some are more have more affinity to interpersonal issues in design. So I thought that was an interesting way of looking at design, and very valuable. And that's where I use that framework, and especially from cognitive psychology.
Absolutely. And so before we kind of dive into each individual, I just wanted to make special note that, you know, often when talking, whether it's with students or clients, you kind of describe that architects, the phrase I've always used is master, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. Whereas I actually prefer your comparison that an architect is like a decathlete, maybe not any kind of specific specialization, but performs consistently in a diverse set of skills and functions.
Yes, absolutely. And that analogy to a decathlete, where you have to perform in different areas at a optimum level, you don't have to excel in those, but you need to have some sort of a competency. One of the architects that I met some years ago was talking about design is the last of the generalist professions. And that was an interesting view on design. And also David Allison from Clemson University, who runs the healthcare program, talks about designer being a generalist specialist, right? We need to have a general set of skill sets, but we could also excel in some of those areas. So for me, that was an interesting take in how design operates, because it's one of those skills where you need to know a lot of it, but at the same time, be able to perform or use some of those in a very deep and intense way.
Right. Great. And so now we'll go into each individual section. So we'll start off with, you know, the idea of intrapersonal skills versus interpersonal. If you could elaborate not only on the difference between the two, but how your research showed that they play into our design intelligence.
Sure. Generally, when we think about architecture design, we tend to think of architecture mainly focused on spatial skills and logical skills, right? Those are the two skills that we are trained in, and we always use it explicitly. The great thing about multiple intelligences, it lets us, the use of other skills like intrapersonal, interpersonal. I also add another skill called suprapersonal skills. And the main difference among these three is they are all coming from this idea of using personal skills to influence design. So intrapersonal means you're trying to use your own personal history, your own sense of the world, how you compare metaphors to design, personal knowledge about experiences that you had, emotions and meaning. So intrapersonal is coming from that perspective that a designer can use some of the personal kinds of issues to inform design. And the example I give is two famous designers, Daniel Libeskind and Peter Zumthor. Yes. For me, someone like Daniel Libeskind is fascinating example of intrapersonal skill, because just looking at his Jewish museum design and the conceptualization he goes through using culture and values he brings into the process. In fact, when I visited the Getty Research Institute to do some archival research on his process, I found 19, I think there were almost 19 books just documenting his conceptual process. And the analogy he makes to the Jewish culture in terms of Torah or the book burning or the baggage strewn on the streets. So he brings this into his final design, and you can see that analogy. Same thing with Peter Zumthor's sensitivity to materials, for example, and then how he brings his own past to inform the design process. So intrapersonal is coming from your own personal perspective, which is opposite to something like interpersonal, where you need to now understand other people other than yourself and design for them. And the great examples for interpersonal skills are someone like Alejandro Aravena, who uses social persuasion. He brings in community design into his thinking. Great example is the Quinta Minroy project, that where he used the half house concept to use some participatory techniques among communities to design. One interesting anecdote or an example he gives there is the community, when asked about what do they prefer between a bathtub and a water heater, usually the community would have ordinarily said a water heater, because you know it's more elaborate and it's looking into the future. But they actually preferred the bathtub because they could do many different things. They could wash the children, they could do other things with the bathtub that the water heater couldn't do. And he mentions about how that decision came mainly through that participatory design technique. So understanding others and values of others is interpersonal intelligence. The third example I give between the within the personal intelligence is what I call as a suprapersonal intelligence. And yes, suprapersonal intelligence is going beyond personal, going beyond interpersonal, to think about, you know, the immaterial and philosophical and the spiritual world. Two people that are a great exponent of this is Lu Kahn, who talks about design being a spiritual transcendence for him. And also I have added Zaha Hadid in that category because of the conceptualization she does with her projects is fascinating, coming from this whole idea of suprematism and having the space free itself and not be confined. So those are the three personal intelligences that I talk about in the book.
Great analysis of the three. And so moving on, you've already hinted at this, but the two that any architecture student or any professional hears 1,000 times a day regarding the logical, mathematical, and the spatial, you know, nobody has to be convinced that architects understand the spatial intelligence. And I do know many people, whenever I tell them an architect, instantly say, oh, you must be great at math. And the reality is, I'll be honest, I'm not the greatest. I wasn't the greatest at math, but it's more of a logical strength, I would feel. And I think many others would agree with that.
Yes. And it's interesting how designers use logic and math. Some of them kind of literally use numbers and geometry. But you can also think of logic as formal variations You can think of logic as being able to respond to functional and programmatic issues. I have some students who right away when I give them a design project, you know, start with calculations and numbers. And I come to realize, there you are. Here's a student who likes those numbers and the number crunching. I give examples of Le Corbusier and Greg Lynn for this category because both of them use mathematics in different ways. Le Corbusier, for example, was a great exponent of the grid system and the Cartesian order and the whole idea of modulo that he tries to use in his projects and very rigorously using it in various conditions, right from the scaffolding as well as the windows or, you know, even at the building scale, the site scale. I think that was an interesting example of logical mathematical intelligence. I also give the example of Greg Lynn, the recent exponents of parametric design as an example of logical mathematical intelligence because the way they bring in computational methods, algorithms to design. And I think that's another way of looking at mathematical and logical intelligences. The spatial intelligence, of course, we are very aware of in design schools, in practice. One of the main criteria for architects and designers and interior designers is to visualize space.
Absolutely.
And some designers could do it much better than others. I give examples of Frank Lloyd Wright and Tadao Ando as examples of this and very different exponents of spatial intelligence. In fact, you don't find a lot of sketching or conceptual drawings done by Frank Lloyd Wright because he had the gift to manipulate space in his own mind. And after a long time of manipulation, he would then put it as a finished or completed drawing, which was fascinating that only few designers can do that. And then you have others like Tadao Ando, who do a lot of, they start with sketches and they start with doodles and trying to understand space. And Ando, of course, comes from his cultural background of using space in a different way, the whole idea of time and space and how space is related to time, the whole idea of Jikan, he calls it, the spatialization of time. And also not just space, but also thinking of the void as an important element of architecture design. He calls it the ma. And the void also has a value. It's not a negative kind of value, but it's intense and very wholesome. So so that's the spatial intelligence is, of course, is something that we are very aware of. And obviously, some designers are much better at manipulating space than others. But it's an important aspect of design thinking.
Absolutely. And so I'd like to make special note of two of the intelligences, particularly because when I first read them, I kind of thought to myself, I'm not so sure if I'm using that a lot. And then while reading into your research, I had the epiphany of, oh, wait, myself and every other architect does this every day. And it's the idea of the kinesthetic intelligence and the naturalistic. Like I said, at first when reading that, I might say that I don't do that. But as you pointed out, the human scale is something we have to deal with almost every decision we make. And then same with naturalistic, we don't build our buildings in a vacuum, you know, whether it's sustainable or not, we have to deal with the surrounding environment. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on those two.
Absolutely. And as you said, yes, we don't think of kinesthetic intelligence as something explicitly being used in design. But right, as Juhani Palasma talks about, architecture is an embodied act. And when we think of design, we think of body movement, we think of spatial orientation, we think of how we view space from the inside. The two examples I give for spatial or bodily kinesthetic intelligence is Stephen Hall, the whole idea of parallax, that you're able to experience overlapping perspectives. And Stephen Hall's design process is also very interesting. He usually starts from the interiors and then goes outside. And he does a lot of beautiful watercolor paintings to kind of depict those moments. Same case with Hermann Hertzberger, another well-known designer coming from the structuralist tradition. And one of the reasons I put Hermann Hertzberger in the body kinesthetic category is his whole idea of social activation, how he thinks about people and how he thinks about people moving in space, be it school or an institution. So bodily kinesthetic intelligence is something that designers use a lot, but probably not explicitly. It's hard to kind of depict it in a certain way.
Absolutely.
And same thing, as you mentioned, about naturalistic intelligence, the whole idea of that we are connected not just as objects, but to the natural world. The two examples I give you, one is Chris Cornelius, and the other one is Geoffrey Bawa. Chris Cornelius is a very interesting architect. His whole idea of storytelling and the use of nature and bringing cultural traditions from his native Indian background to tell stories and mythologies about how design and nature works together. In fact, he feels sustainable design is more like a name that we give, but really it has to be a part of every design process. And then the other example I give is Geoffrey Bawa, who is a famous tropical architect who designed beautiful houses embedded within nature in Sri Lanka. And some of his drawings are also fascinating because he just doesn't draw the building, but he draws the flora and fauna, he draws animals, he draws, vessels like catamarans, he draws different types of trees. So you can see in his conceptual drawings how much nature is part of the whole process.
Absolutely. And so, assuming I didn't miscount, so that brings us to the eighth and final kind of point in the way you organize this, and the verbal linguistic. And this one I have my own special attachment to.
Okay.
I think many of my students think I harp on the necessity to be able to talk, persuade people, explain. And so I think you kind of go into a great depth that it's not just about conveying your design. There is sort of, and you already talked about social persuasion. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little more.
Yes, and it's interesting because as designers, we spend a lot of time verbalizing our projects to our clients, but we also can see a verbal process that we can use in the conceptualization of design. And Maya Lin is a great example of that. The whole project that she did, the Veterans Memorial, When the project came about, I think there were a number of entries, almost 10,000 entries in this particular project. And when the reviewers were going in the golf cart, you know, all these entries were put in this huge stadium and they were trying to spend a couple of minutes on each project in a golf cart. And initially, when they looked at the design, they just passed it over, but apparently they had to come back and just read the concept statement. And when reading the concept statement, they were kind of surprised and stunned about how beautifully descriptive it was. And that was one of the reasons, the attribute that she got the commission for it. So there is a power in verbalization in terms of how it can influence design. The other example I give is the Bernard Tschumi. Bernard Tschumi, of course, uses the syntax of the language to influence his design, coming from the whole idea of deconstructivist movement. that design can be a narrative. And his earlier influences from literary texts and how he uses some of those texts from James Joyce and other literary personnel and brings it into design. The fascinating thing about Bernard Tschumi is he had to invent a whole new language to depict that in architecture. And so you can think of language as a syntax that could be used as well in the design process.
Great. And so, you know, one thing I'll kind of end this with is the book is very interesting, whether or not you are an architecture student asking what this is, someone in the field who maybe has gotten hunkered down with the technical reality and is wondering what design is. So I find that very interesting. And so one thing I'd like to ask you, you know, since the book's been released, though, you know, what have you been working on? What have you been working on?
Yes. So first, I'm trying to recover from this book because I think there is still work to be done in terms of disseminating it to appropriate audiences. And this is one reason I'm doing the podcast, as I felt your audience has had a long history to experiencing what new books in architecture has to say. And I also want to get more feedback from my colleagues, and that's the fascinating thing about knowledge and how it develops. You put out a conjecture, and then you figure out, you know, what's the next step. So there is some work that I'm still doing in that area. I also have interest in another whole area of design called environment behavior. Environment behavior, in simple terms, is how psychology, psychology affects users and how users experience buildings. And so I've been writing about it, especially with this new COVID era and the pandemic. And we have a lot of interesting traditions in psychology, environmental psychology, specifically talking about some of these issues, and I'm trying to revive and lessons learned from the past that we can actually use it for today. I was actually listening to one of the podcasts that you did about the great interiors, and I think there is a revival that is happening in this area that I'm interested in.
Absolutely.
Another area that I was always interested in and I'm working on is the emerging media and how it affects our thinking about design. So tools like immersive visualization with augmented reality, virtual reality, artificial intelligence, all these are affecting the way we are thinking about design and also communicating about design. And I'm particularly interested in its implication to underserved populations to communicate the whole idea of design and make it more accessible. So those are the three areas I'm currently working on.
Very interesting. Virtual reality is a bit of a passion project of mine. I can't wait to see where you go with that.
Wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you again for speaking with us today.
It was my pleasure, and thanks for having me, Brian.
Oh, absolutely. The book is The Multi-Skilled Designer, Cognitive Foundation for Inclusive Architectural Thinking. For everybody listening, thank you and have a great day.